to the Narrator Roundtable. How are we doing this week, and who do we have at the table tonight? I'm Gail, by the way.
I'm Andre. I'm doing well and swell, thank you.
I'm Lindsay, and I'm so excited to be here today with y'all.
This week, we're focusing beyond narration just slightly. This is the Narrator Roundtable, but there are many people that lend their skills and energy to the creation of an audiobook. Some of those roles are more obvious or more talked about, such as the author, the producer, the engineer, the proofers, and some of those are a little less discussed in our world, or oftentimes maybe not even present when they should be, such as a director, marketing team members, the sensitivity readers, listeners, and editors. There's a whole team of talented, hardworking humans that are required to bring an excellent audiobook to life. And it's important for narrators to really understand and deeply respect all the members of the team, even if they never interact directly with them. So today I've brought a really special guest on who I feel like represents a huge swath of the roles in audiobook land. Our guest today, as she calls herself, is a technical-minded Broadway fan and self-proclaimed Reaper Queen. Jennifer Blom is also an accomplished narrator, director, engineer, producer, and more. She has her own production company, Reaping Audiobooks, and wears many of the aforementioned hats for Macmillan Audio. Welcome, Jen.
Hey, friends. How's it going?
It's great. We're so happy to see you.
Yeah, I'm happy to see you all too. It's always nice to come talk to actual friends. And sometimes you say that word and you're like, well, I don't know you yet, but you're a friend I just have to make. But y'all I know, so hey.
So there are like a bunch of things that we could discuss with you today. I mean, we can start wherever anybody wants to, but you have such a comprehensive experience in the world of audiobooks. I thought it might be interesting to hear about sort of how you've cross-pollinated your education of how to make an audiobook in your many different fields of expertise. And what would you say like some of the biggest benefits to working across such a varied scope in audiobook land are, you know, like when you're working in one position, are you taking with you into when you change hats, you know?
Yeah, I don't have a big wardrobe in real life. So changing hats is probably the same hat with like an extra feather or something in it.
Yeah, so that works.
Basically, it's always going to carry my same set of skills with me. That was a really bad metaphor that I'm sure if someone's like, that was bad. That's fine. That's my jokes and deal with it. That said, I got into it kind of as a backstory of when I started working as a narrator, we had to learn all of it, right? Like, how do you record yourself? How do you send it out into the world? And the first few projects I did were royalty share. So I'm like, I don't have the money to pay someone to do this, even though Lord knows I don't want to listen to my voice the whole day. But I ended up doing both. And then come Christmas time around my first year, my first few months, somebody like reached out and was like, I need someone who knows Reaper to help me with this editing project. And I'm like, well, I edit for myself. I haven't edited for other people, but I'm happy to say sure, and I'll just figure it out. And so I said yes to that, and that was quite a few years ago. And then, yeah, I took that whole philosophy of you say yes, you learn, and I learn from every experience, really. Like, anytime I am listening to an author record, a lot of my directing is for author reads. Every time I'm listening to a seasoned professional such as yourself, Gail, we're just there. I've worked on studio with Andre too. I have done post for Lindsay. Like, I learn something from each of those moments. Anytime I hear anybody's voice telling a story, their approach to how they tell the story, it seasons my own performance. I don't like to say that I replace anything that I do because that would be a lie. But anytime, it's just like, when we listen to audiobooks, we learn from the person we're listening to. We respect something they do, and we're like, wow, that would really be an extra good flavoring for what I do. It's just like adding a little bit more to my special sauce, you know, that I'm going to serve the family, whatever. But that is where I kind of come into it. It's, I will say yes to most things, like within the audiobook industry, and be like, sure, I'll give it a try. I'll do it. And that's the way I've added a lot of those hats, saying yes, making sure that I ask the follow-up questions to know, what am I agreeing to? Are you sure you agree that I have this skill set before you like put me in the room? And usually it's just that. It's asking clarifying questions to figure out like what steps you need to take to make this project successful. And then you just do it. That is how I've approached most things in life. And I think that has lent itself really well to joining the audiobook community when I did and my progression.
I'm kind of wondering, like, is there anything in your journey so far where you vet the asks, that is good, and you make sure that you feel like you're qualified to take on the ask, but is there any role that you've played, freelance, working for Macmillan, you know, I don't know, is there another option? Yeah, but you've worked for, like, Ty Def Studios, you worked for other audio companies as well, but, like,
yeah,
is there anything that you've been like, whoa, I didn't even know I could do that, now I have this new skill set, or, like, I didn't even know this was a part of audiobook production, like, you know, I'm thinking of something in particular, but I'm curious what you might say.
Yeah, a lot of the things I did and have done and still do for audiobooks is just a matter of being like, sure. And I never knew that existed. And like, okay, I know this now. So going to that same thing, something we did was we did an edit for someone who took over that position from me, like, because I had too many hats. They had a acquisition where we actually had to do another round of edits for sensitivity reads. So sometimes if they buy like an indie project into a publisher's house, they might listen to it and see like, hey, could we reword that? Mm. Or, you know, is everything, you know, on the up and up as far as that's concerned? Doesn't mean necessarily the content. It's more word choices within the content.
But does it affect the content when you change the words? You know what I mean?
I am not someone who's actually chosen the new word, but based on what I have observed, usually no. It's more sensitivity focused rather than meaning focused, right? Like calling somebody a thing versus, you know, a whore or something of that nature. Like, ultimately, they're still like a slightly degrading version of the same thing, but in context, it becomes important to choose the right one of those options that they have, right? Because one is a choice and one is a like a choice from the character's perspective and one is I am degrading you just for the sake of it, right? So I think that becomes important, but it was interesting to see that in action, just to see the new script and what the old audio was and kind of just like, huh, I can see where that would be a useful swap, and I kind of wish that selfishly some of the indie books would go through that same you know, just overview for their own books, because I think a lot of them choose editors, but sometimes sensitivity is not necessarily on the forefront, and since we, you know, basically all of us narrate some form of romance, I think it's important that, you know, we can still talk about a love story and it can still have, you know, the gray areas that some people love in their stories. But that doesn't mean we have to degrade the listener or make them feel icky in the same process, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and even just the step of having a human being look over the story before it's taken further in the creative process and offered to a listener or a reader at some point is like something that sometimes gets skipped over. And whether that's about, you know, taking sensitive language into consideration, or it's about like technical proofing, you know, it's like, I feel like a lot of that just doesn't happen in a lot of instances. And it really, as a listener, as a reader, like I can tell, and it makes a world of difference to me when that care has been put into the story being told.
So especially important when an author is writing about a character or an event that's pretty far outside of their lived experience. I feel like those sensitivity readers make a big difference because, you know, you want as many books as possible to be fairly diverse. And that means the one singular author is going to be writing, including characters or subplots or whatever, that are outside of their experience. That's a legitimate thing, in my opinion, to include in a book. But then I think that requires, you know, taking that extra step and saying, let me pay someone who does have that lived experience or something closer to it to inform me if there's something I'm missing or something I'm just not aware of or thinking about.
I think like one thing that's coming up for me is this recurring idea, I think, about what an individual audiobook means in the context of one production company or one publishing company's portfolio. Because I think, do we set aside money for sensitivity reading? Do we set aside money for engineering? Is there budget in this for a second round of proofing or whatever it is?
Yeah.
I think all those things I think contextualize for me because there are definitely places where the portfolio of like project to producer is super high and they just don't have the time.
That is a problem with the budgets. Some people cut them so razor thin that they forget that spending a little bit extra to get it done the right way will make it an even better product than the
And I think there's a lot of consideration for folks. I think like the accepted narrative in audiobooks seems to be the big super mega seller books pay for all the rest of them, right? Like that's I think how a lot of people describe and approach it. I have one example. Like and I'll name this because I believe that this is like written out in an article somewhere. I don't have the details about the situation. But I think that it was Emily Wu Zeller was narrating a book where she found some like, I think the writer was white and there were some really clear discrepancies in how they handled, I think it was like two different East Asian countries, like maybe Chinese versus Japanese culture. And there were some mistakes and went back to the author. I'm not sure how, if that was through the producer, to encourage them to change those things. And so like, and especially in the context of sensitivity readers too, I think like, especially in romance, we're playing with taboos. A lot is happening here. I think that there might be overarching pieces that are not necessarily like the narrator is going to stop and then just like make an adjustment and go back. And I think that's where, especially like you've framed, when we've got these indie projects who didn't necessarily have all the benefit of like, you know, the traditionally published hubbub of who like 10 people are going to read this before it goes out to anyone, is how, you know, do we navigate those positions?
Yeah.
Or how do we like acknowledge it, especially if we only see it while we're in the middle of recording? And if it's something that challenges us, because I can't imagine how many folks have come up into the middle of a book and they're like, oh, that was like overtly racist. Not in a, like the author is challenging this way, but that was just overtly racist. Like, what do I do next?
If that was a thing I came across, I would definitely shoot my producer or like the author just a message going, hey, I think the strength of this scene like may not be affected by me not saying it, but I just wanted to bring it to your attention. So, you know, you ultimately are involved in this discussion and have an open dialogue about it, because I think I speak for most people, like respects a good boundary, especially when it comes to performance and knowing what your limits are and when you don't want to touch
them. This is interesting to hear because it feels tricky to me when I encounter something like that in a book. And please correct me if I'm wrong. My perception here is that like, whether it's an indie book or a book being done, like picked up indie by a publisher or a big five book, by the time that manuscript is actually in our hands and like hits our desk or whatever, we are some of the last people who see it before it goes live.
Mm-hmm.
That's also correct. I feel that pressure because, you know, even if it's an indie, oftentimes the indie ebook, the indie paperback has already been out for ages before they have the money.
But I would add to the indie part that most of them do a direct print paperback. So like if you're doing it through Amazon, you would sell it on Kindle and you can make an update to a Kindle book really quickly. And then they like buy through Amazon the paperback, which means it's usually print on demand. Mm-hmm. They don't print a huge volume of them, which means that if they do correct it, maybe there's like 5 or 6 of them that go out with that, you know, questionable scene or whatever. But then they will be able to have the next batch not affected. It's an ask. We're all adults. I think if they say, hey, we really just need it read as is, then that's, you know, what happens. Like that's part of the script being set and we just do it. If it was on stage, like most of the time, even if there's something, you know, uncomfy that we come across, we get through it. But it is one of those things. If it's a boundary like problem, then that should be addressed. And maybe the casting wasn't right for this particular project.
That process, I think, often drives me to think about, like, you know, you were talking earlier about like these different skills, and the phrase in my head is like, we are the anthologies of everyone we've ever encountered. So I love like Jen as this kind of like multi-talented, like
I have a particular set of skills.
And so I think like in that way, all of these conversations are about emboldening the author's art, right? Sometimes.
Yes.
Sometimes the author is the villain. Is the villain in the conversation? I don't know. That sounds so dramatic. We absolutely love you.
Love you. Day.
No, I mean to say that, like, you know, like I come into something in a book and it's like actually, again, very problematic. And it's clearly not like being presented as a criticism. It's like this is just bad. And that's to say that, like, I don't know. Like you when you think about what your outcome is. Someone is the action point of that outcome. If you're like, this should really change, like that has to reach back to the author, right? If you're like, we shouldn't have this in audio, that has to reach back to the producer. Like someone, you know.
I actually had a funny pronoun pickup moment when I was working on a book a little while ago and during my initial read, like when I was narrating, I was like, oh no, there's a typo and this character is being misgendered. And it wasn't deliberate in the book, but I was like, this is a non-binary person. Their pronouns have been they, them the whole book. And now they're using she, and that was a mistake. And I'm just going to correct it as I go. And I was so ready when I got the pickups to be like, actually, I corrected that on purpose. And then when I got the pickups and listened through to them, I realized that the character talking to this non-binary person was also discussing Carly Rae Jepsen. And the she in the sentence matched to Carly Rae Jepsen. So I'm like, I'm sorry, you're right. I should have said she because we were talking about Carly in this moment. Thank you so much.
And this is why it's all a team effort, everybody, because no one is infallible. Yeah.
We had a little bit of a chat about this recently as we were talking about like audiobook narrators and doing your own proofing when you're in a traditionally published process. And I think like what it is to me is being aware of everyone involved in the process clarifies what it means to collaborate on the project.
I think that just all ties back to the same thing, understanding what their pain points are, what your asks are. Mm-hmm. It's really easy for me to negotiate usually now that I'm a narrator, like, and that I'm like, oh, hey, I'm going to just like ask, like, when is an editing team going to actually touch this? Is Monday morning okay? Or are they planning on touching it over the weekend? Is that what that post house is? If not, can I have until Monday morning to send you the rest of these files or whatever it is? It's a very easy ask now because it's very related to how they interact with the post team. So they can easily answer that. But if you're wishy-washy and it's like, I might need more time because I blah blah, then they don't think you're thinking about the whole team. They think you're just thinking about yourself, which makes that a little bit harder to negotiate.
That has been such a huge piece for me in terms of like ADHD and then knowing like who's impacted down the line too. The amount of time it took me to learn which companies, when they say, oh, this is due on, you know, November 21st, mean that the morning of November 21st, we want our team to be able to get into the studio and start working versus people, like you said, who are like, you're going to turn it in on Friday. and we're going to come into the studio on Monday and work on it. Or the folks who are like, we want you uploading as you go because someone's going to be behind you every single day and you're going to be getting pickups as you go.
At least try to give them as much as you can each day, but just finish it when you finish it. Some people get sick and then they're like, they're going to hate me for the end of time. It's like, no, they're just as human as you are and they know things come up. Just tell them what you can offer and don't apologize so much that you forget, hey, we're all on a team. It's like, hey, I got sick. I need more time. I will upload as I go because I know you need to be working on this too. And this is when I expect to have the final files up. We good? And they'll be like, yeah, we good.
Jen, are you arguing that the humanity of the production process makes the product more human?
Oh, snap.
Yeah, I am. Oh my God. It's amazing how like everything having a human touch is better. And with that, I think the interesting part of that conversation is tools in general and the team you choose are only as effective as how you interact with them. Mm-hmm. So that includes the A word we're not going to say right now, but it is like, it's important to remember that aspect of it, right? Like it is a tool.
Yeah.
Like Positron is a tool. It can be used really effectively. It can be used really poorly, but that doesn't mean the product itself or the technology behind the product itself is the enemy. It is the people with that tool that use it, that make the thing. Like access is one way or the other. I will not go into that soapbox, but I think the crucial part to remember for that is we can be scared of a tool, but if it's in no one's hands, right, that's using it for the things that would take away jobs from us or do things that would hurt us, then it's not necessarily just inherently bad.
Yeah.
So that same, okay, fine, AI. That same technology can be used.
Stop it.
But I can't. Okay. It's a small point, but like that same tool can be used to save a lot of lives with the ability to do research very, very quickly. The same stuff that can be used for nefarious reasons can be used for really, really good reasons in this world. And I worked on this book as an engineer. Cindy Kay narrated it called The Worlds I See. And it's talking about how, and it is a brilliant book, but it was talking about how the development of AI happened out of the reasons most technology happens. It's inherent curiosity of the spirit and trying to make something better for the world, right? So in this case, it was trying to recognize via AI what's in a picture and like making it searchable for people and making the ability to research much quicker. But that inherent thought process, how you think about how to solve for that problem, gave us access to a lot of other things because it opened up that, like if you're looking at a brain, like that neural network, that neural pathway was opened up and now connections can be formed with that new destination.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to think about it from a scientific standpoint and to remove ourselves from the immediate danger of the moment, right? Cars were scary when they first came about, right? Like they're commonplace now, but if you were used to like walking around or, you know, on a horse most places, and all of a sudden like these cars are zooming by and you're like, wait, I can't see. I have sand in my mouth because there's not proper, like, I don't know. But, like, I'll stop with that analogy. But the point still stands, right? Technology can be scary. It always will be when it's something new and unexplored. That is part of the book, too, is, like, how do you use it responsibly? And how do you ask for the protections for yourself and others when it's being used? And that is the path we're currently on. But I am very much like on my high horse of not being afraid of it because there is nothing that can help us in being afraid of a tool, in being afraid of a scientific breakthrough or discovery. It is something that we are now going to add into our world and into our surroundings. And it doesn't have to come for every part of every job And it doesn't have to take away humanity. It doesn't have to do any of those things. But that is a different dialogue than I don't want it in our business, because it's here. And it's not that I'm saying we just have to deal with it in that sense that, like, some people say it kind of flippantly, like, let it take some of the jabs, whatever, like in this, they're all from 1930s. But that's not what I'm getting at either. But I think opening our minds to the possibilities of what it can do that's really good for this world, and letting it live in those spaces and grow in those spaces and help the lives that it can in those spaces, and being okay that it might temporarily, because it would be temporarily, like, hurt the storytelling community, because it's going to be very short-lived, because storytelling storytelling, like, is one of our oldest passed along things, right?
Human,
like,
rituals.
Writing.
Yeah.
There would be sitting around the campfire, there'd be chatting, they would be telling stories, they'd be passing down histories to each other with the spoken word. It is an inherent need. And I just don't think that AI will come for it in the way that, in the complete totality that some people are talking about it like it will. I don't think that's coming. Will it impact some? It'll impact every single profession, some. But I don't think there's a totality there. So percentages. If it's an 80-20 split, if it affects 20% of our business and we still get to deal with the 80 or whatever that number is, we're still doing fine. Relax, ease into it. I wish I had, like, you know, in The Wedding Singer, where he, like, undoes his shirt and he's just like, relax. He has, like, the shirt underneath. If you've seen it, there's like 8 people in the audience that are watching this that have seen it.
No, I'm a big fan of the movie, right? AI voice specifically being used for traditional text-to-speech uses. So somebody who is using text-to-speech to read their emails to them, or to read a textbook to them, or, like, things that they encounter in their everyday life, like read a recipe to them. I'm also a big fan of it in terms of, like, people who want to create their own synthetic voice, either for, like, their own purposes or because they're losing their voice due to something like ALS or other degenerative conditions, and they want to be able to have a synthetic voice that they can use that sounds like them. I think that, like, those uses are miraculous and are wonderful and make the world more accessible. It's just, like, I just wish y'all would focus on that. Because also my other...
but it's, you know, to quickly add to that, because I do want to hear your next point, I just wanted to add to it that the fact is, to make those things better, temporarily, it has to impact what we do just by proxy. Because here's the thing, that's where the money is. So if the money goes into audiobooks or podcasts temporarily, it'll help develop all of these amazing things that then, it's like self-driving cars, I use that example. Like, oh, we don't use it for every car right now, but we do all parallel park an awful lot better because of the skill sets that learned because it was going to drive itself.
No, so that's a really good perspective. I definitely appreciate that way of thinking about it. I was going to say the other thing about a lot of the way AI technology is used in terms of, like, consumer products these days is that, and I know this because I used to work in a bunch of different tech jobs as, like, part of my day job when I was an actor in Chicago. I was, like, a client support person. I worked for all these different tech companies in their office. Oh my gosh.
You too? A too?
Me too. I didn't do, but I was more like, let me teach you how the software works.
Oh, I did all of it. Discover Card, DirecTV, like.
So you might also be familiar with this, okay, but sorry. In terms of, like, you know, a lot of people in tech, especially when, like, because this was many years ago when, like, AI was being, AI or generative AI, or even, like, essentially, like, language prediction models were being applied to writing many, many years ago, especially, like, technical writing and, like, marketing writing. And the people who were, like, pitching it and who were, like, really excited about that technology love to talk about algorithms in any sort of tech as, like, something that's neutral, you know, right? Like, it's this neutral thing. Like, it just takes all the information and it spits this out, and it doesn't have the biases of a person. But all of these technologies are created and fed by, like, a very narrow portion of the population, generally. Not everyone, I'm sure, but, like, a lot of what I encountered was. So
100%.
For all this, like, yeah, yeah, it's no bias. It's like, no, it is your bias. It is often patriarchal. It is often white supremacist.
Please read this book. Please read The Worlds I See, because it actually talks about the bias that's inherently in anything you design. I didn't talk about this hat, but I was a junior software engineer right before I became a audiobook person. But I was training to be a junior software engineer, and writing algorithms was part of that job. And just like anything else, just like your writing, if you went and write a book right now, mm-hmm. your bias is showing when you write that algorithm, when you write that book or whatever. Everyone has inherent bias. Even though you all told me very nice things about myself, if I wrote something, there would be bias showing. Whether it's bias against people that are horrible to other humans, it's still a bias. It is still something that I personally have written into that. It's also the power of how you ask a question. And I think that is part of an algorithm, but it's also what any mechanical learning in AI is based on. If you ask the right question of the tool, it becomes more powerful for you. So I think that's what you were just saying.
The danger is not in saying like, not in create, like don't create anything, because if you're correct, everything will have a bias. The danger is in saying we've created something without a bias, because no, you haven't. You never have.
Right.
And no one has ever done that. The like fail safe that you have in terms of human storytelling, in that like when I'm narrating a book, I bring my lived experiences, my biases, my understanding of the world to that book. And when Andre or Jen or Gail narrates a book, you all bring your perspectives. And what that means is that when you're listening to like multiple audiobooks, you're getting, and same with those authors who wrote the books. And I'm sure even like the proofers who are going through them and who maybe are like, no, you know, if a proofer is more comfortable with a foreign language that's sprinkled throughout a book, they might catch more mistakes. Like every person in the process is bringing their experience to it. And so you end up with like many different biases and many different experiences, but all like, all at the same time, all smooshed together. So you get a much richer, wider variety of experience.
Isn't it lovely being human?
Whereas like, if it's like, hey, we have these five artificial voices, it's a very narrow thing that you have created to tell very broad stories.
And that's why I kind of like where the union is currently headed as far as its discussion with AI. Like as far as I realize that the contract, we don't have all the language, but the contract itself at this point is very confusing, I think, for you know, a lot of people, because we don't know all the dotted I's or whatever, but they're having constant meetings afterwards when this is, you know, if it's ratified. That said, I like that the conversation currently is on usage, right? That means that you can sign off, you know, for this is on film, but if we did something similar for voices later, you get to decide how your voice or how anyone's voice or what percentage, just like in theatrical right now, like a percentage has to be real human, right? Like on a set, a percentage of the set has to be real human. That is part of the contract. So like that is an important thing too, because if you extrapolate that, let's say to audiobooks, if 80% or 90% of all the books they put out has to be human read, and the other 10% or whatever, doesn't. It could have the label like AI read or whatever. That is still okay, right? Like that is part of it, right? Like it's those type of things. It's having the conversation of wanting multiple voices, wanting, because you have multiple voices, you as the actor can, in my dream, the impossible dream world, can have an AI read book, right? But you do like a pickup session as your human voice to be like, okay, but these scenes are really important to me. And these are the most emotionally depth ones. So for like an hour or two, you come in and like make it even more you than like, you know, it's not a full human read, but like your pickup session will let you fix like the sections that you find most important to make it even more how you would tell the story. Won't be perfect, but it's not perfect we're going for. No one's perfect. but it will help you make it slightly. Although
honestly, like that,
better. But that is still going to be listed honestly, as AI.
Like, maybe other people feel differently about this. That sounds like a nightmare scenario to me, because like I'm in this industry because I want to do the work. Like I want to be working. You know, like I don't want to give the work to someone.
And this
else.
Is only some of the
even
books.
If it's me.
Let's think about it though. But let's think about it, though, in the bigger perspective, right? Like the amount of work you do in any other industry within performance, you add to your offering, right? You can only do certain amount of stuff in person on stuff. So whether it's narration or you do TV too as well, like you can only do so much with your time. If you license out, let's say you're also a musician, and you licensed out one of your songs and that gets used, you know, in a TV show and you make residual income from that. And then this other thing happens. A lot of your time is still used doing what you love to do most, right? Because you're mostly signing contracts with your human red voice doing the voice and doing the thing, and it's all you. This is just saying, in addition to that, like these textbooks or this, you know, e-learning thing, I'm going to license out my voice for that, because then I don't have to be sitting there for the 57 hours to record all of that, but I still get some residual income or some money from it. And, you know, that can be working for me in the background. It is a different stream of income. It is not replacing your ability to be the amazing performer you are.
I think what I was thrown off by was hearing like, here's a scenario, you know, where like most of the book is AI, but you re-record like the emotional scenes. I'm like, if there are scenes in this book that are important, then the whole book is important, you know, like rather than like, this is a textbook,
that
you know,
was
like,
a,
and it's, yeah. This would be text to speech, but 100%. Instead it's you, you know.
What I was getting at more for that, you know, very basic example is if you license yourself out for a lower paying project where right now you would do technically royalty share, let's say. Because they can't afford the amount that they would pay for a full PFH if you did royalty share. You don't have to, like, sign your name up for anything. This is a hypothetical for other people might use it for. So don't give me that look. It's all about me. But no, like, in this world, if they tested the book out, let's say they don't have the budget for it now. And so then, like, they used to do abridged versus unabridged. This way they do AI versus human read. So let's say a book comes out that they don't have the budget for, maybe it's indie, and it goes out as an AI that you have licensed your voice for. What I was saying is if they then add, you know, paying you for an hour of your time, you can sweeten up the, you know, most powerful, impactful moments to make sure when you sign your name off on it, you have given like, as much as it is AI, you have given it your seal of approval. That is just a hypothetical. You can also just have it read it and be fine. But
kind of like an artist print versus like an original.
Right. Original 100%. And work. Then the exactly, Gil, like I think that adds to it. And then you can, if it does well, kind of like what Andre was saying earlier about budgets, then you can be like, okay, now we're going to flip the bill and pay for a human read. Same narrator, different narrator, as far as your licensed name will probably be different, but like you can then choose as the rights holder, okay, the human read version will be by X, Y, or Z. And then that can have the label of human read, which technically in my hypothetical pickups could be done by AI. So like in my theory, 90-10 split, if it's AI, it's 90% AI read, 10% human. Pickups would be done by a human, like if we don't think that worked or whatever. And then the other side would be 90% human read, 10% or whatever.
No, it's AI. Absolutely. No, it's fascinating. But it also like, it actually circles back to our beginning discussion about encountering things in books that are objectionable or that we want to make note of or whatever. Because this is another one of my anxieties around AI. Actually, like very, very early on in the AI voice movement, one of the companies did reach out to me and was like, hey, we are looking for a voice actor. And this was before, like, you know, I'd even heard of it. And I was like, oh, okay, interesting. Ooh, I can license my voice. Fun. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to look into it. Well, I mean, it wasn't a, like, yes, I'm doing it, but it was like, I don't know what this is yet. I'm going to like start moving through the process, see what's going on.
Look into.
And for me, one of the big sticking points before I even got to the end of the process was like, when I was like, okay, cool. So if you guys have my voice and you license it out and I get paid anytime someone like chooses it from your database, I get to approve those projects, right? Like I get to look over everything and say yes or no. And then we're like, oh, no, like.
Mm-hmm. But that's what the negotiations right now are.
Right, right. Because it's inefficient. Right? But that's the thing is like, part. Whenever it's like, oh, you could have, you know, your AI voice just like read a book that you don't even have to look at. It's interesting because, like, you know, our voices are so powerful, especially our human voices, but like our voices are powerful. And I'm like, when I lend my voice to a story, I am amplifying that story. And that's really important to me. And like the one power I have as a voice actor now is if I get a script that I think is highly objectionable or I think is going to cause harm or something, I say no. And, you know.
Right, but that is something you would still have the power to do, and that's exactly what I was saying, right? Because it's something that you still sign off on. Like, when you get a royalty share currently,
right,
you still look at the script, you decide if it's worth it, and you say yay or nay. That is what I'm hoping, because of how they're currently working with the consent process. Like, that is project-specific and theatrical. If they keep that for audiobooks, then we would have to sign up not just for this service, we would each project, we would be contacted like, hey, mm-hmm. I want to use your voice, but AI version of it because I can't afford your, you know, full per finished hour rate. So this is the book I'm wanting to use it on. Please review it like you usually would before you accept. You get, let's say in this hypothetical scenario, like 2 to 3 days to review it and accept or not accept, because or a week or whatever it is, because it's pretty quick to generate once it's done. And then you get to decide. So you would get to search for all of the things that you wouldn't want your voice saying, like, is this about a political figure I don't want to be associated with? Okay, that's a pretty clear no, thanks. But like, that is, I think, where the power comes in. Because then you have your tool, your voice, just like you were saying with your synthetic voice that you use. Like if I lost my voice for any reason, like I would be able to license it for myself. That's the type of thing we're getting at. But the contract needs to just be adjusted. And once the theatrical one's done and sets a precedent of like, hey, per project as a union member or not, if they're a signatory for the union, no matter if you're union or not, you have to say, yes, you can use my voice for this specific project only, not for anything you want until the end of time.
Here's my truth before I go into these conversations. I am a pessimist. I just listen.
I would have never known.
And I do, like, my degree is in sociology. I think a lot about, like, the interconnected implications of some things. And then I also just generally look at companies and go, that's actually mm-hmm. a professional title on a plaque is look at companies and go, and I think about the AMPTP in the course of the negotiations. Like you just mentioned, you're going to come in for a day rate and then we're going to scan you and then we're never going to need permission from you again. Which I want to note, functionally now, the day on which you get scanned, if you're doing other work, there's a certain rate. If you're not doing other work, there's another rate. Both are equivalent to a day rate. And like you said, that there's consent required, but the union isn't establishing rates or minimums for AI. So you're responsible for your own negotiation. And I think that like...
Equivalency means that at least that minimum has to be reached, right? Like, so the reason I don't think that it's written out explicitly in the contract is because it depends on exactly what they describe and what they say is. But as far as I understand it, if like the shoot was X days, if you were in person, they would have to pay you for those X days using you as an AI. So like, that is why I think they haven't explicitly said like AI rates, but they did say equivalency, because it would matter what those specific terms are listed. And I think, so that's why I'm like, I'm hesitant to be like, they're definitely trying to, you know, pull one over on us and make us do all the negotiations for money.
No,
I think it's more.
I wouldn't.
hard to
list. I think there's been a lot of back
specific.
And forth about the negotiating committee. And I don't, my framework is not that anyone on that negotiating committee wants to pull one over on union members. That is not, I feel you. I'm saying though, I think like one is, I think about the challenges of casting in the market, the audiobook market that we're in now. There's a lot of talented narrators. There's a lot of new narrators. Studio isn't a limitation. And I try to ask myself very realistically, in a world where we are navigating, where someone who is casting is just exploring AI voices, I cannot fathom the reason that if the difference between my price and Dion Graham's price, if our voices both have an AI, if the difference between our AI voices is significantly smaller than the difference between, you know, his PFH rate and my PFH rate, I, just like, you know, Apple, they picked their four voices. Whatever speech key has its core. Like I don't envision a world in which everyone who is, or even 80% of people who are narrating full time, are going to be asked to all replicate their voices and are all going to be able to like move through their same kind of, you know, income needs in that context. Like that, I don't feel like I'm sitting in a space right now where books cordoned off for AI are going to be cast that broadly, that it's going to touch all of us somehow.
I will raise you. I see what you're saying, and I will raise you. Poker Thames. Yay, we love that. I watch World Series Poker once, and I know all of it. Just kidding. But I will raise you that I think where I see it going is this. You know, those same people that reached out to you, Lindsay, that were like, hey, this is how we can bring your voice and like sell it out. Those same companies will realize, oh, they should have the power over what's licensed. Kind of like the Writers Guild of America. Like when in their agreement, you can use your own writings to feed into an AI and then use that to spit out, you know, something to help you get started, but it can only be your, you know, personal intellectual property. So let's say we extrapolate, and that is not lawyer talk. No one come sue me. I was just my understanding. But if we take that in the realm of AI, let's say you can go to a website and just like on ACX where you can choose your own adventure and find a group, right? Let's not, you know, necessarily keep it with Amazon. Let's say it's a different company. But like, if you can upload your stuff and it's, you know, within the agreement that only you can use it, so you push it out like as needed, there's a software that lets you personally have control, like this, feed in this product and then spit out the MP3s for me. I can do a listen through myself before I send it out, just like, you know, before. And then once it's approved, you send that out. I think that's more what it's like. I don't think it's necessarily the ACX or find a way model where someone logs in and's like, oh yeah, this voice, you know, necessarily, but if they see your website and you have then the power to say, okay, these are my rates, instead of saying royalty share now, I say, these are my AI rates, these are my human read rates, I set them for myself. In your example, Andre, I think it's very similar to that. Like if we were thinking of Dion Graham, hey Dion. But if we were thinking, okay, Dion sets his rates, you know, in his like golden voice tier of like, this is his PFH, then he's probably not going to go much lower than half of that to do his AI voice, you know, that kind of like the royalty share plus. So I think that's where it comes from. Just like anything else, there'll be a minimum of like what the per finished hour is, like a union minimum. And then there is the sky, the limit for the rest.
But why? What's to stop?
One of the
reasons that we have a limit on our, you know, royalty share plus rates is that time is a factor, right? So we only have so much time and energy to contribute to a project that we're investing in, even if we're doing it at a lower rate than we normally would. But if our AI licensed versions of our voices are doing it, like, what what is the limitation there that's going to create, you know, equitable rates in that regard?
So they want your voice, right? Like, they know that you sound amazing in middle grade, let's say, which you do.
Thank you so much.
But they can't afford your, like, this is, let's say, indie, right? So they can't afford your, you know, bigger rate. So with the AI, let's say there's an agreement that's similar to the Royalty Share Plus. And I love that I'm talking with all this authority of no agreement is made in this case. This is not
I mean, real. Listen, I hope the future goes as you envision it, because it has a lot of faith in the goodness of people. But I'm just,
but,
yeah.
Like, the point was more like, if we replace how we think about royalty share with AI instead, right? So, like, it's a Royalty Share Plus agreement, let's say, where they, a little bit of the royalties go to the person that's voice they used, and, you know, lesser PFH. Like, that means that the things that you would have taken a chance on with your voice for royalty share, like, if you were that, you know, narrator, would now be something you take a chance on with, you know, your licensed voice and that type of thing. Because then you're not investing all of this free time where the book might not sell a single copy.
I will also say, I think I have only seen one company take that model so far, which has been Lotus Productions. Who's this? In terms of actually executing AI that way, of like, well, this is this actor's
voices.
Voice.
Yeah.
It's going to be them. It's going to be about consent. It's going to be residuals based off of the projects they say yes to. And in our space, the people we have seen move forward with AI, it's the Amalgamated Voices. It's, we got a golden voice, allegedly, to make this one voice. And so I think that's part of it for me. And like, the other piece to my pessimism, too, is this reality about market flooding. Which is that if the idea is that all of these projects where, you know, like people say, we're often starting on ACX with this tier of project, or the, you know, the places where people cut their teeth are the spaces where AI is the most competitive. I think that one presents a challenge for new people down the road. But two, I think it also discourages people from spending more on audiobook production, because if the point is, oh, I want to sell 500 copies of this AI audiobook before I produce it with real people, you've learned that you can sell 500 copies of an AI audiobook without producing it with real people. And I think that's
right.
A decision point for people that I am, again, acknowledging, looking at pessimistically.
Right. And as the optimist in the room, I will counter your pessimism with a very healthy dose. I'm a realist. I'm an optimist, but I'm also a realist. And real talk, yes, it will, in fact, impact the industry. It'll impact not just, like, audiobooks. It'll impact podcasts. It'll impact, like, YouTube videos will be faster to put out with, like, you know, and already have been with the monetization they can do through that. So here's where the discussions come in. Like we were talking about before, the usage of a tool and who has the power over how that usage is controlled. So if we have, let's say we eventually go rule one with audiobook narrators or whatever, that means any co-sign, like, person that uses the union to hire their talent will be led to, oh, you have to do an 80-20 split. It has to be 80% human, 20, or whatever it is. Like, that is a very hypothetical number. It'd probably be much smaller because of how much books get put out. But if each producer puts out, like, 100 books a year, let's say that's, you know, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 books per, like, big five, like, that is still such a small subset of all the books available that don't get an audio at all. So I think that's part of it. There's a lot of numbers, variables, discussion points to have. I think the most important part is that you have to sign up your voice only for a project and not, like, just give it blindly. Because anytime you give your voice blindly, someone can use it for 1,000 projects like that. But you're unlikely to, Lindsay, get 1,000 people approaching you in one day asking for your voice that you have to then look through and approve or not approve, right? So I think that is the biggest part. That said, yeah, it's going to be painful for a little bit while we all figure it out together. But storytelling and the form we tell stories, and I know I've told some of you, you know, this in person, that can adapt and change. So if it doesn't mean we do single voice audiobooks, and it means we do more multicasts or more big production, like cinematic audio stuff or other ways to tell a story, stories will still be told with our voices, with our skill set. We'll all go Liam Neeson on this and
listen.
Take him now.
Jen, you are officially, like, you are the Reaper Queen and you are the Liam Neeson of audiobooks. I'm calling it now. This is your new title.
We heard it.
I'll add
first.
It to my signature. But I believe in the art of storytelling, and I know we all do. And I know scary words will be scary and technology will be scary, but I still believe in the connection between human spirits, and that can't be replaced with, like, if Terminator has taught us anything, except for, like, the thumbs up, like, being destroyed, and, like, we're still gonna be here and we're still gonna tell stories, is all I'm saying.
Come on. The Narrator Roundtable is produced and hosted by Andre Santana, Deanna Anthony, Gail Shallon, Kurt Graves, and Lindsay Dorcas. All copywritten material is shared with permission. Music and sound effects are licensed through Storyblocks Audio. All opinions shared are those of the individuals and do not reflect the positions or policies of any company or organization with which they happen to be associated.